The nuclear industry works hard, works overtime, to separate the issues of nuclear reactors, cleanup of radioactive contaminated sites, and the current buildup to another nuclear arms race. Right, like they have nothing to do with each other. But then you hear from someone who really knows what's going on and is able to connect the dots, and he says,
"We have a coordinated attempt across the country by the Department of Energy to do cleanup on the cheap, to leave contaminants in the ground, in the water, while at the same time, exorbitant sums are going into the so-called modernization of the nuclear weapons stockpile, the nuclear weapons research and production complex, all of this fueling an increasingly serious and destabilizing nuclear arms race. This is nuts. And in part, it's being paid for by cleanup on the cheap."
Well, when you hear something compelling like that from the head of Nuke Watch New Mexico, it's not surprising if you find yourself squirming a little bit in that uncomfortable seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a breathtaking interview with Jay Coughlin, executive director of Nuke Watch New Mexico, a watchdog group that keeps close tabs on the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and much, much more. Jay shared things about the country's nuclear infrastructure that I'd never encountered in more than 8 years of producing and hosting Nuclear Hot Seat, and he did it with great clarity and economy. So this is an eye-opener. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than we have been told about the vulnerability of nuclear power reactors facing the wrath of Hurricane Dorian. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, September 3rd, 2019, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., a win for activist community members and sanity, as plutonium test results have stalled the plans for a toll road near Rocky Flats. Plans were for a toll road that would cross on the east side of Rocky Flats, a former nuclear weapons plant northwest of Denver. But in August, a soil test found plutonium levels 5 times higher than the cleanup standard. And the deafening, nonstop pushback has forced Broomfield City officials to suspend their search for investors to help build the Jefferson Parkway. Broomfield City Council announced that the parkway is not moving forward at this time. Off the lower Atlantic coast, Florida nuclear plants announced on August 30th that they were ready to shut down as the threat of Hurricane Dorian loomed. But as of this morning, September 3rd, while the St. Lucie plant did register an unusual event, step 4 on the 4-step Nuclear Regulatory Commission scale to kiss your ass goodbye, they did not turn off the power or turn down the power. In fact, every nuclear reactor on the East Coast is still operating at 100% power, which is not a good idea when there's a possible flood event coming. You don't want to play nuclear chicken with a Category 5 hurricane. In Southern California, the owners, contractor, and regulators of the San Onofre Nuclear Power Lemon are facing a new lawsuit over fuel storage plans. The nonprofit group Public Watchdogs is asking a federal judge to halt the on-site transfer of spent nuclear fuel at San Onofre until a full hearing on the project can be convened. The lawsuit names majority plant owner Southern California Edison, minority owner San Diego Gas and Electric, Holtec International, which designed and built the low-grade storage canisters now being loaded with high-level nuclear waste, and, of course, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We'll have much more on this in next week's program. In Massachusetts, 96 organizations have joined the call to suspend the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's Pilgrim license transfer to Holtec. On August 22nd, the NRC finalized the transfer from Entergy to Holtec without addressing petitions to intervene and requests for adjudicatory hearings by the Massachusetts Attorney General's Office and Pilgrim Watch. Organizations from states where Holtec is directly involved include California, New Mexico, New Jersey, New York, Michigan, and Massachusetts, and all have joined the petition, requesting the NRC suspend license transfer until all the contentions on radiological, environmental, and financial concerns are heard and resolved. Holtec's partner in the proposed decommissioning, SNC-Lavalin, is a Canadian-based company involved in a political scandal and controversy in Canada, which has led to its shady business reputation. Another California story, and this one is numbnuts adjacent. Central Coast Assemblyman Jordan Cunningham has introduced a new bill that could keep Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant open. How? It would amend the California Constitution to define nuclear power as a renewable energy source. No, 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 no. Jane Swanson of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, a nonprofit organization concerned with the dangers of this type of energy source, said, "Nuclear is not a renewable form of energy by any stretch of the imagination. Just because nuclear fuel is not renewable. Tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide are put into the atmosphere during the mining, the milling, and the enrichment of the fuel. It seems the only thing endlessly renewable about nuclear is the idiocy of those who support it." And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, numbnuts of the week.
Hypersonic missiles, stealth cruise missiles, and weaponized artificial intelligence have so reduced the amount of time that decision makers in the U.S. would theoretically have to respond to a nuclear attack that two military so-called experts say it's time to give artificial intelligence control over the launch button. I mean, really, what could go wrong? And how many bad movies include that plot point? In an article entitled "America Needs a Dead Hand," U.S. deterrence so-called experts Adam Lowther and Curtis McGiven propose a nuclear command control and communications setup with eerie similarities to the Soviet system Dead Hand, which was a semi-automated system developed to launch the Soviet Union's nuclear arsenal under certain conditions, particularly the loss of national leaders. These two military Tweedledum and Tweedledummers say that U.S. leaders would be under such time pressure, quote, "It may be necessary to develop a system based on artificial intelligence with predetermined response decisions that detect, decide, and direct strategic forces with such speed that the attack time compression challenge does not place the United States in an impossible situation." No, you doofuses, nukes place the U.S. and the rest of the world in an impossible situation. You just want us to get there faster. Now, these guys just love, and you can hear the overtones in there, that this system would bolster the United States' ability to respond to a nuclear attack after the fact. That is, ensure a so-called second strike capability. It would adopt a willingness to preemptively attack other countries based on warnings that they are preparing to attack the United States. In other words, saber-rattling, like North Korea does all the time. And, of course, they could always destabilize that country's adversaries by fielding nukes near their borders. I don't know what they mean by fielding, but it doesn't sound good. While the Soviet dead hand system could only be launched after a nuclear attack by three officers deep in a bunker, would set off rockets that would fly across the country, initiating the launch of all the Soviet Union's remaining missiles in a sort of revenge from the grave type move. But Lowther and McGiffin say a hypothetical U.S. system would be different from dead hand because, quote, the system itself would determine the response based on its own assessment of the inbound threat. That is to say, the U.S. system would be better because it wouldn't necessarily wait for a nuclear detonation to launch a U.S. nuclear attack. We'll have more on this in today's final thought, but for now, Lowther and McGiffin and anybody who takes these guys seriously, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
In Japan, Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, is considering decommissioning one or more of the seven reactors at the Kashiwazaki Kariwa nuclear power plant in northern Japan, in exchange for which they will be allowed to operate two of them. But TEPCO was asked in June of 2017 to come up with a plan for dismantling at least one of the reactors, and TEPCO has missed that deadline. And in Russia, further confirmation that the mysterious explosion on August 8th that released radiation came from the explosion of a nuclear reactor. And the doctors who treated the victims of that explosion, despite being forced to sign non-disclosure agreements, have revealed that the irradiated victims of that accident were treated just feet away from pregnant women, children, and those who were seriously ill. One doctor said, after we started operating on the victims, dosimetrists arrived and measured the levels of beta radiation and then ran out of the operating room in fear. They confessed that the beta radiation was off the scale. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, nuclear stories and areas of crisis keep multiplying almost as rapidly as our tons and tons and thousands of tons of radioactive nuclear waste. It doesn't matter where you live. Between atomic radiation from atmospheric bomb tests still circling the world in the jet stream, to the dangers posed by that nuclear reactor down the road, abandoned uranium mines, or the ramp-up of the new nuclear arms race, we're all in that nuclear hot seat, like I tell you every week. And the best defense against it is to know exactly what's going on and how to resist its spread. Now in its ninth year, Nuclear Hot Seat remains one of the only places where you can get a one-hour hit of honest nuclear information every week. Interviews with activists, genuine experts, a roundup of international news, as well as numbnuts of the week, bad puns, and anything I can do to lighten up some really heavy information. So where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to the nuclear industry propaganda and lies and the mainstream media's dead silence? Of course, we operate on the equivalent of a bake sale budget, and that minuscule budget is dependent on you, the listeners. So this is my invitation to you to help us keep going. We make it easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to send a one-time donation or set up a monthly donation of any size. And to send us a monthly $5, the same as what you would spend on a cup of coffee and a good tip here in the U.S., just click on the big green donate button at nuclearhotseat.com. Please, do what you can now, and know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Here's this week's featured interview. Sometimes it feels like following the various nuclear stories is like a game of whack-a-mole. You go after one, and three more stick up their ugly little heads and defy you to get to them before the next six pop up. And the nuclear industry likes to keep all those issues separate from each other, so you don't get to see the patterns of the abuse, the ignorance, wrongheadedness, greed, and stupidity. I think I missed two of the dwarves in there, but I'll find them. That's why it's a powerful experience to speak with someone like Jay Coughlin, executive director and one of the founders of NukeWatch New Mexico. In the organization's 20-year history, It has repeatedly fulfilled its mission statement to promote safety and environmental protection at regional nuclear facilities, mission diversification away from nuclear weapons programs, greater accountability and cleanup of the nationwide nuclear weapons complex, and consistent U.S. leadership towards a world free of nuclear weapons. Boy, wouldn't that be terrific. I contacted Jay initially to learn about recent meetings held with the Department of Energy on the so-called cleanup of radioactive waste at Los Alamos National Labs. And as so often happens, the interview turned into much, much more. I spoke with Jay Coughlin on Thursday, August 29, 2019.
Jay Coughlin, so good to have you with us here this morning on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
New Mexico seems especially hard hit by a wide range of nuclear issues, from uranium mining and the Church Rock uranium tailing spill to the waste isolation pilot plant, the Trinity site where the first atomic blast took place, Los Alamos and Sandia National Laboratories, and the proposed Holtec so-called interim high-level radioactive waste dump. In Nuke Watch, with all of these issues, what do you focus on, or do you try and focus on at all?
Well, really two things. We primarily focus on the Los Alamos National Laboratory. And so two things with respect to that. Its role in the escalating nuclear arms race, you know, which is obviously has far-reaching global consequences. And this is fueled by the Los Alamos lab, both through proposal for new design nuclear weapons and the fact that the laboratory manufactures the plutonium pit cores for nuclear weapons. So again, Los Alamos is on the American side of things, is enabling the new nuclear arms race. The other side of our house is that we work on cleanup issues at Los Alamos, and the two are linked. More nuclear weapons production that causes the mess to begin with means less cleanup effectively in terms of funding and other things. So that roughly describes what we work on. We do pay attention to the Sandia labs, and we pay quite a bit of attention to the waste isolation pilot plant as well.
Give us some background on the Los Alamos National Laboratory. How long has it been there, and how much cleanup is necessary on this site?
Well, of course, it was founded during World War II years, specifically in 1943. And, you know, I'll be the first to observe that it was an amazing technical feat that the U.S. did in those war years of, first of all, building reactors to produce plutonium and uranium, and then Los Alamos developing and manufacturing the bombs that destroyed both Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. So since that time, it's worthy of note, and especially since you're located in California, the one consistent item since 1943 is the involvement of the University of California in Los Alamos Lab, and I'll quickly add also Lawrence Livermore Laboratory right there in Livermore, California. So here we have a state university system that, you know, is generally perceived as being somewhat liberal. But again, it's been in the nuclear weapons business from the very beginning. Now, with respect to how much cleanup is there to do at Los Alamos, well, if you listen to the Department of Energy and specifically, well, I'll just stick to the Department of Energy, which runs the cleanup program at Los Alamos. If you listen to them, there's only some 5,000 cubic meters of radioactive and hazardous waste to treat in one form or another. But in reality, there are at least 150,000 cubic meters of radioactive and toxic waste buried in unmined pits and trenches at Los Alamos above our deep groundwater aquifer.
I also recall that in 2011, there was a major forest fire in New Mexico, the Las Conchas fire. And at that time, Los Alamos was threatened, and there was a fear that by burning through some of these unmarked pits, or even some of the marked ones, that radionuclides would be re-aerosolized, and they would go up in the air in the smoke, and they would be spreading further. Has there been any evidence of that?
Couple of things. First of all, a wildfire will send up naturally occurring radionuclides to begin with. That's kind of as a matter of course. And specifically, potassium 41, which is naturally prevalent. Now, the more serious fire was the Cerro Grande fire in the year 2000 that actually burned some 3,500 acres on laboratory property. The 2011 Las Conchas fire burned to the boundary of the laboratory, and that boundary is a state highway, and that's where, you know, all the firefighters stopped it. With respect to what we know about radionuclides in the smoke, you know, folks in California are going to unfortunately understand, you know, what that smoke is like and how thick and aggravating it can be to respiratory systems, etc. But in the 2000 Cerro Grande fire, first of all, the laboratory and the Los Alamos town site, they were both evacuated, and air monitoring stations were abandoned. The short response to your question of what do we know about what was in the smoke, unfortunately, we don't. We don't. And, you know, just to give you some idea, there's not only the facilities at the laboratory, and none of the major facilities burned, but there are also, like, you know, they're commonly called diffuse points. The lower half of the laboratory, it's largely wooded, and there's been a lot of explosive tests involving uranium, and the result is that there's quite a bit of uranium shrapnel just sitting around on the forest floor. And in fact, in official studies, that's postulated as the highest occupational dose would be to a firefighter fighting the fire in this area where uranium shrapnel could probably be burning up. But again, the short answer is we don't really know what was all in the smoke during the 2000 Cerro Grande fire. Just to give you an idea of the smoke, I happened to be in Washington, D.C. when that fire broke out in April 2000. And I flew back, oh, some 3 days after it broke out, and I started seeing the smoke while I was in the airplane. I started seeing the smoke from that fire in eastern Oklahoma.
And is the reason that we don't know the content of that smoke because people looked and couldn't find anything, or was there no research into what was in it?
You know, again, as I stated, the air monitoring stations were essentially abandoned. Again, the laboratory and the town site were totally evacuated. Only essential personnel, security, remained at the laboratory. Also, these air monitoring stations have filters, and anybody who has been close to a major forest fire knows how much particulate it sends up. And so these filters clogged. And the town site and laboratory were evacuated. The filters weren't changed out. Again, the bottom line, we don't know. We don't know what was in all that smoke.
There have been recent public forums with the Department of Energy and Los Alamos National Laboratory. And at them, they've been claiming that their cleanup of the site quite diminished from the amount that you stated was actually there. But they claim that the cleanup is more than half complete. What do they mean by that? And in your estimation, how accurate is that statement?
Well, we'll get to that right here and now. Their statement is false, okay? They're dictating the terms, they being the Federal Department of Energy and then the local cleanup office here at Los Alamos. But I've already said that DOE plans to treat some 5,000 cubic meters of waste And of course, I don't pull that figure from the thin air. This is so stated in a 2000, what they call a life cycle baseline cost estimate, that first of all projected that cleanup would cost no more than $4 billion at Los Alamos, which of course is a woefully low figure. So again, they plan to treat some 5,000 cubic meters of radioactive and toxic waste while ignoring, they don't even acknowledge it exists, but it's available in laboratory documents, some existing 150,000 cubic meters of radioactive and toxic waste in the laboratory's largest waste dump, which is called Area G.
So they're not even acknowledging the fact that there is more recognizable waste and recognizable waste area that needs to be cleaned up. They're just narrowing their focus, as the government so often does, to this 5,000 cubic meters of radioactive waste. How can they get away with that? And who, if anyone, is there to hold their feet to the fire for something a little bit more honest and complete?
Well, with respect to who's there to make them accountable, there's my organization, Nuclear Watch New Mexico. And, you know, towards that end, some of these DOE sites have what's called citizen advisory boards. By charter, DOE, the Department of Energy, allows them to consider only cleanup matters. But it so happens that I gave public comment just yesterday afternoon at a meeting of the local Citizens Advisory Board, the one that overlooks cleanup at Los Alamos. And to me, this is a little astonishing that the Department of Energy had never told its own Citizens Advisory Board that it believes that cleanup is more than half complete. And so when I made my little presentation, I could see that some of the Citizen Advisory Board members were, you know, astonished, perplexed. But this gets to the question of what does DOE, the Department of Energy, mean? This is what I think they mean, but they need to be questioned. They need to be questioned by the New Mexico Environment Department. They need to be questioned by the New Mexico State Legislature, and they need to be questioned by the Citizen Advisory Board. But it's pretty clear that what the Department of Energy means is that cleanup is half completed, more than half completed is their claim, both in terms of time and money. But what I point to, what NukeWatch points to, is that this is going to be cleanup on the cheap. Again, they're talking about removing, treating 5,000 cubic meters while leaving 30 times as much permanently buried. So NukeWatch characterizes it as cleanup on the cheap, like they did for the Rocky Flats plant near Denver. That was the former site of plutonium pit production, the cores of nuclear weapons. And Rocky Flats, I would urge your listeners just to Google Rocky Flats.
Oh, they know Rocky Flats. We've
been
covering it.
Yeah, it's absolutely notorious.
Wildlife refuge, quote unquote.
Which is not coincidental, because I regard that as a gimmick whereby the government can use a much lower set of standards for cleanup. You know, a so-called recreational standard rather than a residential standard. And again, this gets the cleanup on the cheap. So, you know, to paint a picture for your listeners, and I'm painting a picture, you know, with a broad brush here, but we have a coordinated attempt across the country by the Department of Energy to do cleanup on the cheap, to leave contaminants in the ground, in the water, etc., while at the same time, exorbitant sums are going into the so-called modernization of the nuclear weapons stockpile, the nuclear weapons research and production complex, all of this fueling an increasingly serious and destabilizing nuclear arms race that is going to be very unpredictable. It's not the old bipolar world of the Cold War. You know, there are other players now. I'm saying this as a person who was a kid during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that's the kind of thing we're going back to. This is nuts. And in part, it's being paid for by cleanup on the cheap.
So they are creating more nuclear weapons, more plutonium pits, more waste, and at the same time, not doing an adequate, appropriate, if even such a thing is possible, job of managing the waste that they have already created.
You are generally correct. Now you'll see how anal I can be in terms of accuracy. So it's not necessarily more nuclear weapons in terms of numbers, okay? But what they are doing are extending the service lives of existing weapons through so-called life extension programs. And there's some documentation that, you know, they can take an existing weapon and extend its life by 60 years. But at the same time, they are giving these weapons new military capabilities, which used to be directly opposite to what the U.S. government was saying. For example, I saw Hillary Clinton at the United Nations state, while she was still Secretary of State, that the U.S. had a policy that it would not endow existing nuclear weapons with new military capabilities. But that was a false statement. And I'm not picking on just Hillary. That was said across the country. And ultimately, of course, it was President Obama who was responsible for that policy. But that is woefully false. And the entire stockpile is now being transformed.
So there are new uses being found, more powerful uses being found for the existing stockpile. When you were talking about life extension of the weapons, that's much the same as what they're doing for reactors, except they're not changing them or upgrading them. They're just saying, it can run for another 20 years.
Let me address one thing. You say more powerful. And the world of policy issues surrounding nuclear weapons sometimes seems like Alice in Wonderland. So the irony here is, no, they're not coming up with more powerful weapons. They're coming up with less powerful weapons. They're coming up with lower yield weapons. And the danger is they're more likely to be used. And then once a so-called low yield nuclear weapon, and we're talking about something in the range of approximately a third of the yield of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. But, you know, they still destroy cities, and you use a low yield nuclear weapon. How does it not escalate, you know, into total nuclear war?
I'm not the one to have the answer to that one.
Well, I don't either. That was a rhetorical question, but it was a very serious question.
It is, because I know that the push has been happening from the White House to have what I refer to as the cute little nukes. Let's just use a little nuke in this situation. So it's not as bad as those old ones that we dropped on Japan, but it's just an excuse to commit nuclear war.
Once you use a nuke, no matter what the yield, how do you stop the ladder of escalation from there? You know, I especially want to appeal to the young people that might be listening to your broadcast. I grew up in a military family. I mention that just because I was quite aware of the Cold War when I grew up and the terror of it. And, you know, as a kid, you end up thinking that apocalypse could happen tomorrow, you know, that you'd wake up to a world that's destroyed, a world in which you would not want to be a survivor. And it's just tragic and unbelievable that that's where we're going back to. And I'm not engaging in hyperbole or exaggeration, that's where we're going back to. And, you know, climate change, rightfully so, is such a concern, such a grave concern. But I'd like to point out, you know, what could instantly change the climate? Well, let's have a nuclear war with 100 warheads going off. That'll be followed by a nuclear winter. You know, crops won't be able to grow. There'll be global famine. So, you know, here I am. I'm not dealing in a pleasant subject, but, you know, I especially want to appeal to your young listeners that my generation let you down. You know, how come we didn't get rid of nukes after the Cold War? It's tragic.
I can't contradict you, and I believe we are of an age with each other because I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember being terrified of nukes. And sidebar, I lived in Chicago, and in 1959, the Chicago White Sox won the pennant for the first time in I don't know how many decades. And to celebrate it, Mayor Daley set off at 10 o'clock at night the fire station sirens that were supposed to be used only in case of a nuclear war. And my family went, oh, they're just celebrating the White Sox. And for me, I thought it was over, and I was trying to get my family into the basement, and they wouldn't go.
Right.
And I was, and they sent me back to bed, and I was terrified because I thought, this is it, it's over. And that
right.
was a daily concern.
Yes, it was. And, it, you know, the absurd duck and cover exercises in school. I mean, if it wasn't so serious, it'd be comical. there is no protection.
So let's get this back to where we started talking, which is about the purported cleanup being halfway done at Los Alamos. There were recent public forums that were held. In your estimation, how did those go? And I like to refer to all the world as a stage, and if it's so, nuclear is the worst theater going. How bad was the nuclear theater?
Different levels. On the surface, all was calm, all was good, you know, nothing here. You go below that, a specific objection that I have is that all questions from the audience were to be submitted in writing, and then they were all responded to by the former head of the cleanup program at the Rocky Flats plant. And I believe that is certainly not coincidental. I reiterate that Rocky Flats plant style cleanup on the cheap is coming here to Los Alamos. So there was no opportunity for follow-on questions. There was no opportunity for, call it, cross-examination. And you basically only got to hear the party line, which, among other things, is that cleanup is more than half complete. So the so-called cleanup forums, I think they're just part of an integrated public relations campaign to sell Rocky Flats style cleanup on the cheap here at Los Alamos.
Did the media fall for this line? Is that what they picked up on?
There has not been that much media coverage. The last forum here in Santa Fe last week did have one significant story. No, they didn't fall for DOE's line. They reported basically both sides, DOE and folks, the position of NukeWatch. So that coverage was actually pretty good. But the underlying issue is that there needs to be more media coverage, and NukeWatch is attempting to do that. You know, this can be described as a guns versus butter issue, more nuclear weapons versus cleanup. And the debate needs to be elevated here in this state.
You're calling on New Mexicans to fight back against expanded plutonium pit production, the escalating global nuclear arms race, and plans to leave most radioactive and toxic waste permanently buried, and this is above a major aquifer. What specifically are you asking people to do?
First of all, is contact the New Mexico Congressional Delegation, which has a long history of to use a harsh word, being subservient to the nuclear weapons industry in this state. There's always been like categorical support. And I specifically point to our senators, Tom Udall and Martin Heinrich, who, you know, otherwise they're regarded as basically some of the most liberal senators, certainly Udall, in the Senate. But again, the New Mexico congressional delegation has always pretty much unquestioningly supported both Sandia and the Los Alamos labs. So in terms of asking people what to do, just always in general, it's good to make sure your opinions are known to the congressional delegation. But to begin to be more specific and possible things that the public can do, NukeWatch believes that there's going to be some $5 billion in upgrades to plutonium facilities at the lab over the next 5 years. We believe that legally requires public review and comment under the Federal National Environmental Policy Act. This is something that we are demanding of DOE. We hope to be successful in that. And if so, that then establishes a public process whereby hearings will be required. There'll be the opportunity to submit formal written comment and verbal comment, etc. So this will be in the not too distant future, I would say, hopefully to begin within the next half year. And that will provide more of a mobilizing platform and help elevate the issue. So I regret that right now I can't offer a lot of specifics, but we hope to be able to do so in, again, within half a year or so.
Will NukeWatch be coming up with talking points that people can reference and adopt as their own in their letter writing, in their conversations with their representatives?
The answer is yes. We always do that.
And where would those be accessible?
Thank you. Now I can plug our website, which...
Of course, that's what the show exists for, Jay.
Yeah, that's the point. But, you know, in plugging it, it's a pretty popular website. You know, I can state that objectively. It is www.nukewatch, that's NukeWatch.org. We have a lot of information on it, you know. Maybe arguably too much information, but yeah, we got a lot of information on it, and I definitely want to tout it as a real resource in this arena, this issue arena. And it's also a good way to keep abreast on events and the process, because as I indicated, there's not yet any concrete events or dates, but hopefully there will be. And the best way to check on it is through our website, which again is nukewatch.org.
How can those of us who are involved in nuclear issues but live outside of New Mexico help you?
Well, first of all, deal with the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory there in Livermore, California, about 40 miles east of the bay. Specifically, support our colleagues, Tri-Valley Cares, based in Livermore. And we work closely with Tri-Valley Cares. Also, this merits a little bit of background for your listeners in that there are three nuclear weapons laboratories in the U.S., and they are Los Alamos, which I can look out my living room window from Santa Fe and see the Los Alamos lab. There is kind of the sister laboratory, Lawrence Livermore, again in Livermore, California. And then there's Sandia, which the main facility is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, but it also has a satellite facility adjacent to the Livermore Laboratory in California. And Sandia, in my view, kind of unfortunately flies under the radar. It doesn't have the same notoriety, for one thing, that Los Alamos has, and also Livermore to a certain extent. But Sandia, The nuclear design labs are Los Alamos and Livermore. And then Sandia is like the engineering lab that essentially weaponizes the nuclear designs of both Los Alamos and Livermore and takes their designs and makes them deliverable weapons of mass destruction. So I'm just trying to describe the nexus of the design aspects. Then, of course, there's the production side of the Department of Energy nuclear weapons complex. And what we have currently ongoing is a $1.7 trillion program, so-called modernization, that is an extreme makeover of the nuclear weapons stockpile and its supporting research and production complex, and then completely new missiles, submarines, and bombers to deliver those rebuilt nuclear weapons. And I say rebuilt, I want to point out that we're on the verge of the U.S. going to what are actual new design nuclear weapons as well. So we're going to have production facilities, new ones, that are expected to be operational until around the year 2080. In other words, the government plans to keep nuclear weapons forever. And again, this is such a shame. We should have gotten rid of them after the end of the Cold War.
Would that we had. And certainly when you say they're planning on holding on to nuclear weapons for forever, that may not be as long as 2080 with the way we're going.
Should a catastrophic nuclear war break out, yes, I assume that's what you're implying.
It could happen.
It could happen. That is the unfortunate reality. And I'm going to point once again that the situation, the overall geopolitical situation, is even more unstable than it was in the Cold War because we're not looking at a bipolar conflict anymore. First of all, it's generally recognized as at least tri-party with China, although to China's credit, its stockpile is quite small compared to the U.S. and Russia. U.S. and Russia together possess over 90% of the world's nuclear weapons. China is somewhere around 300 and also has a declared policy of no first use, which both the U.S. and Russia will not make that declaration. But that said, you know, I'm pointing to the inherent instability, geopolitical instability, that first of all, we're tri-party with China. Then, of course, we got North Korea, possibly Iran, since Trump busted the nuclear deal with Iran. So as bad as the Cold War was, and it was truly terrible, and we faced apocalypse a couple of times, not only with the Cuban Missile Crisis, but in the present geopolitical hierarchy, it's even more unpredictable and destabilizing.
Well, Jay, I look forward to speaking with you more in the future. We should only have a future.
I'm still an optimist, and the sun comes up every day.
You know, as long as it's a full upright position and you're above ground, it's better than not. Jay, you've certainly given us a lot to think about, a lot to take action on, and we'll stay in touch. And I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Jay Coughlin, Executive Director of NukeWatch New Mexico. You can find their website at nukewatch.org. And of course, we will link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 428. Activist shoutouts! A new website with the seemingly lurid name Chris Busby Exposed is actually a good thing. Christopher Busby is a British scientist and expert on the health effects of internal ionizing radiation. He's a director of Green Audit Limited, a private company, and scientific advisor to the low-level radiation campaign. He's also been the target of numerous vicious, untrue attacks on his credibility, which have been caught up in the online echo chamber and magnified beyond reason. So this new website has been created in order to counteract the web attacks on Chris Busby's credibility, which have been increasing recently in proportion to his success in creating serious questions about the health effects of ionizing radiation and about the health effects of exposure to uranium weapons. The main problem has been misinformation and bias, which has been inserted into Busby's Wikipedia entry, which has been difficult to counter or take down. Hence the new website. So go there and take a look at the accurate reporting of the work and record of the real Chris Busby. It's tremendously impressive. Again, it's chris.busby.exposed. There's no .com or .anything. And if you'd like more information, you can listen to my interview with Chris by going to Nuclear Hot Seat number 333 from November 17, 2017. And, of course, we will link to it on the website. And just for fun, we're going to link to a short non-nuclear interview with New Zealander Kevin Hester. Kevin was an early supporter of Nuclear Hot Seat and remains a ferocious one. We interviewed on the climate change nuclear insanity connection for Nuclear Hot Seat number 233 from December 8, 2015. I told you he goes back to the early days. Kevin is a lifelong veteran of the Eco Wars, and he currently produces and hosts Nature Bats Last, where he talks the difficult talk about abrupt climate change and the exponential nature of global warming. But in this short interview, we get to hear a little bit about his life on a tiny New Zealand island and what real community there looks like. It's nice to know he's got that to fall back on when his place on the cutting edge of the eco wars gets to be a little too much. Here's today's final thought. I know I used this story as numbnuts, but I've been unable to let it go. I'm haunted by the thought that there are people in the government, in the military, and who knows where else, who think that putting artificial intelligence in charge of whether or not a nuclear weapon gets launched is a good idea. History is replete with instances in which it seems, in retrospect, that nuclear war could have started were it not for some flesh-and-blood human being refusing to begin Armageddon. Perhaps the most famous such hero was Stanislav Petrov, a Soviet lieutenant colonel who was the officer on duty in charge of the Soviet Union's missile launch detection system when it registered 5 inbound missiles on September 26, 1983. Petrov decided the signal was an error and reported it as a false alarm, refusing to take the action that he was under Soviet orders to take. His human decision was the right one. Whether artificial intelligence would have reached the same conclusion and decision is, at the least, uncertain. All this reminded me of science fiction writer Isaac Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics, which were the ultimate strictures under which any robot, which of course operated on artificial intelligence, was allowed to exist. These were law number one. A robot must not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. Well, shoot. If you are programming artificial intelligence to launch nuclear weapons that will destroy millions of human beings, along with rupturing the entire web of life, that kind of blows this first law. The second law of robotics? A robot must obey orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law, which, as you've heard, has already been broken. If the mental midgets in charge of nuclear abdicated their launch responsibility to AI because computers are so much faster than human reactions, the computers would probably have nuked our target to automatic retaliation against us and our retaliation against them and so on and so forth to ultimate planetary smithereens before a human being could think or move quickly enough to intervene. The third law of robotics: a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law of robotics. But if the nukes get launched and retaliated and re-retaliated, will anything human or conscious continue to exist? Or will AI, safely down in some ultimate bunker, just take over the planetary reins and survive while humanity goes down in flames, remembered only as a distant, flawed precursor organism to the superior AI. Would you put your destiny in the hands of a computer? Open the pod bay doors, Hal. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, September 3rd, 2019. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, miningawareness.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear International, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN, the Union of Concerned Scientists, bloomberg.com, KUSI.com, San Diego Union Tribune, Public Watchdogs, Cape Downwinders, KEYT.com, Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, ABQJournal.com, Asia.Nikkei.com, Newsweek, TheBarentsObserver.com, Geopolitics.co, and the totally compromised dimwits at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who are in no way protecting people or the environment. A reminder that Nuclear Hot Seat is now available on all of your favorite podcast platforms, Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play. So however you prefer to listen to your podcast, you'll find them there. It's available at tabs at the top of the website landing page, or you can just do a plain play on the page or download. And if there's a platform we have missed, let me know, and we'll load it up there as well. Another shout-out and wave of hello to KNIZ 90.1 in Gallup, New Mexico, which is the latest broadcast station to carry Nuclear Hot Seat every week. And in their case, it looks like it just might be twice a week. I want to thank all of you who are listening from around the world on six continents and joining with each other to learn nuclear truths and learn what we can do about them. If you would like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email to you every week, it's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down and look for the yellow box, and sign up for a weekly email link to the latest show. Now, Nuclear Hot Seat also depends on you, the listeners, to let me know if there is any nuclear issue happening in your own backyard that you would like the show to cover. I can't guarantee I can get to everything, but all information is stockpiled and referred to and will be included as best we can. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And please, just because you post information to me or reply to something on Facebook does not mean I get it. The email is the failsafe, so send it to me that way. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. We will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019. Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with a date when it's over, because once it starts, it's never over. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. Now don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.